Hopefully it's going to. There we go. All right. Says it's recording started. Good evening, dear people of Earth. Another 2024, the first podcast of this year. Here with Professor Kevin Knuth. Is that the proper way to say your name?
Knuth.
Knuth. It is. Knuth. See, I knew it was Knuth. I kept saying that, and somebody said that was wrong, and I was like,
"That's fine. It's the Scandinavian pronunciation, and that throws people off." So yeah.
Nice. All right, got it. So, Professor and I have been talking back and forth for a good couple months here or so. We had discussions in our email threads about UAP physics, some other stuff that UAPX had been doing, some of the calculations that the professor had been doing. And I've been fascinated with the physics of UAP for, well, since I was a little boy, really. Knowing that things are up there in the air, that we're flying around, that we're moving so fast. And it goes back to days when my dad was in Vietnam and things that he saw when he was there and told me about as a young boy. So it was certainly something that in my entire life has been a fascination for me. So when you graciously gave me the time to, you know, go back and forth and have some discussions, I was very excited about that. But I wanted to kind of touch on some of that first, because One of the ones that we talked about first was the encounter with Kevin Day and the Tic Tac and that whole grouping of things that occurred during that time. And I've spoken with Kevin about that.
Yeah.
And what I wanted to do is let you kind of take over a little bit and talk about the calculations that you made and the observations that you made of the data that came out of that. So I'm just going to kind of let you speak and take over and blow everybody away, because I was certainly blown away. That's for sure.
That's right. Yeah, no, that the 2004 Nimitz encounter was interesting and unique in a number of ways, in that there were a sufficient number of independent observations that from which one could estimate speeds and accelerations, which isn't always common. First, you know, these objects were detected by Senior Chief Kevin Day, who was operating the radar on the USS Princeton, which was in the Nimitz carrier group. And he was monitoring these for, I think, a total period of about 2 weeks. And they would appear on his radar. So these unknown objects would appear on his radar, very high altitudes, around 80,000 feet. Up in the north, they were located off the coast of San Diego. So these things would appear on radar at about 80,000 feet, quite high, just around Catalina Island, just south of Catalina Island. And they would typically appear in groups of, I think he said, five or so objects at a time, and would subsequently drop down to about 28,000 feet. And then they would cruise south along the coast till they got to around Guadalupe Island, which belongs to Mexico. And they would cruise south at very, very low speeds, at about 100 miles an hour, 120 knots or something like this. So
that in and of itself is anomalous.
That in and of itself was odd, yeah. Because you've got these objects flying at 28,000 feet where there isn't much air. So typically you have to fly at high speeds to stay aloft. And so the fact that these things were only moving about 100 miles an hour at that altitude was very, very odd. And Senior Chief Day noted that periodically you would get one or more of these objects dropping from 28,000 feet to sea level. And they would do this very quickly. And on reconstructions of the radar data, they were able to measure this time to be about 0.78 seconds. So they would go from 28,000 feet altitude to sea level in about 0.78 seconds, so 2/3 of a second. So 28,000 feet is, you're looking at five miles up. It's dropping 5 miles in less than a second, which is really remarkable. Now, that what's interesting about that is that allows you to estimate the maximum acceleration that these things could have been going, or a minimal acceleration, actually.
Minimal, yes.
We don't have access to the radar data, so we don't know their trajectory and their path, their flight path. But we do know that starting at 28,000 feet and then ending at basically zero feet at sea level in 0.78 seconds. So there's two extremes. You could have the objects instantaneously accelerate to a maximum speed and just cruise down at that constant speed and then just stop. Also, again, with instantaneous acceleration, which isn't very realistic. But you could estimate a minimum acceleration. And so the minimum acceleration comes from the fact from a situation where you would accelerate halfway and then decelerate at the same rate for the second half of the trajectory. And that would give you an estimate of the minimum acceleration. So that situation is nice because it allows us to say they are at least accelerating at that rate.
Right.
So if you compute this acceleration, it turns out to be quite high. It's about 5,600 Gs. So 5,600 times acceleration of gravity, which is really, really remarkable. I mean, we can't.
And the top end of human, the top end of a human being able to handle that type of acceleration is what, around
10 to 11 Gs, 12 Gs for milliseconds, right? Very short periods of time.
Right.
Most equipment can't handle things like this. So like our new F-35 fighters can't handle more than about 13 Gs before the wings rip off. So we can't even construct equipment that can do this. Missiles are designed to handle higher accelerations, so they can handle up to about 30 Gs and still make maneuvers. The basically frame of the missile starts to be compromised around 60 Gs. So something in 5,600 Gs is totally unreasonable. Now, that type of acceleration means that you're also moving very fast at the midpoint. The midpoint is where you're moving your fastest speeds. You can now estimate this. So at the midpoint, with that minimum acceleration, the craft would have had to be going about 45,000 miles an hour. And then decelerate, right. So at the midpoint, you would have to have this object going 45,000 miles an hour. So you're looking at, that's basically the speed of the New Horizons spacecraft that we sent to Pluto. So the probe that we sent to Pluto and is currently in the outer solar system is traveling about 45,000 miles an hour. That's about how fast it's moving.
It's traveling through a vacuum as well. So you're not getting any.
Well, it's right. It's traveling.
Yeah.
Well, these things are anomalous in many respects, which I think is the difficult thing for people to appreciate. So not only do you have an anomalous acceleration, anomalously high, not only the speeds anomalously high, but you're moving through air, which you should have a shockwave, you should have sonic booms.
Right.
The thing should be a fireball, basically, at those speeds. You get a spacecraft re-entering at 17,000 miles an hour, which is about how fast our spacecraft travel that have people on them and are orbiting the Earth. Those things are fireballs coming in. So but there's no fireball. So we don't understand this. And this fact leads many people, many scientists, to say that, look, clearly something's wrong here because that's just impossible, which I understand that reasoning. It looks impossible, but that's what the data keeps telling us. This is what keeps being reported time and time again. These speeds and accelerations aren't new. Hermann Oberth, who was a rocketry pioneer, he was the mentor of Wernher von Braun. And Hermann Oberth gave a lecture in the 1950s on UFOs where he reported them moving at speeds something like Mach 60, which is around 40,000 miles an hour, right? So in his lecture, he actually states that he has seen over 50 radar recordings of things like this. So So this was known in the 1950s. It was well known by those who were involved in the 1950s. And in Kevin Day's report, you know, what he's reporting that he observed on the USS Princeton in the 2004 Nimitz encounter really only supports what, you know, is supported by what Hermann Oberth reported in the 1950s. It's consistent. You know, these observations are consistent.
Right. And we actually have a situation where with the Japan Airlines, we actually have the data because this is another case that we discussed, because the person that was supposed to hide that data decided not to, and in fact kept the data. So we have it.
Right.
That's another case.
That was the JAL 1628 case, Japanese
Airlines.
And
that thing moved so fast, you broke my brain on that one.
Right. Well,
have the data for it.
I have to credit Daniel Kumbi for analyzing that radar data. When I wrote my first paper, I didn't have that data. And so I was estimating the excess speeds and acceleration from the reports from the pilot. Which ended up being far below what was actually estimated by Professor Quimby from the radar data. So there existed. So what happened was, this was the Japanese airline case. They were traveling from Paris to Tokyo, bringing wine to Tokyo. It was a carrier plane, bringing Beaujolais Nouveau to Tokyo, which now you get to. Everybody gets to giggle, ah, ha, ha, the pilots must have all been drunk on Beaujolais Nouveau. Mm-hmm. No, that's not what happened. It's nice to giggle about these things, but we're past the giggling stage. It's time to take this seriously.
I think so.
It's time to take this seriously. And that plane was followed for 45 minutes across Alaskan airspace. And the radar data was recorded for this event. When the object was described by the pilot as being the size of 3 747s, there were actually multiple UFOs when the encounter began, but it culminated with there being a large walnut-shaped UFO that was about three 747s in length. You can do the math. That's about the size of an aircraft carrier. So he's basically reporting something as big as an aircraft carrier flying around his airplane for 45 minutes. This isn't just he spotted this and made a mistake. When this object was in front of the plane, he couldn't see out of the windscreen. That's how big it was. You don't make mistakes like this. This is serious.
No.
And you can tell from, you know, and you can see that in the transcripts from him talking to air traffic control. He's panicked and he's trying to take evasive maneuvers to not collide with this thing. Now the FAA had this data, and the FAA chief of accidents and investigations was in possession of this data and had looked at it. And then at the time, Ronald Reagan's science team wanted to meet with him and get a hold of this data. So they showed up with people from the CIA, from the FBI, and they demanded all of that data. And he did a clever thing. He copied it and kept a copy of it in a box under his desk. I mean, that's all he did. That was Callahan who did that. And thank God he did. So that data exists today for us to look at. And, you know, and this is the stuff that, you know, that we now are interested in, that where we know that the government knows about these things and isn't telling people. Because this is one case where we actually have a copy of that data. We know how that data was taken by the federal government and by Ronald Reagan's scientific team, by his science advisors. So we know that they had copies of this, the data, and they saw it. And at the time, and he reports that Callahan reports that they were excited because this was the first time that they had 45 minutes of radar data on one of these objects. Right. I mean, that's a long time. That's a lot of data. Mm-hmm. And so Daniel Kumbi had analyzed this data and found that the object was making It was staying about, if I remember right, about 7 miles away from the airplane. It was basically making passes past back and forth and around the airplane. And in several of these passes, he estimated the acceleration of this object to be 10,000 Gs. So 10,000 times the acceleration of gravity, which is twice the amount that Kevin Day is reporting from the Nimitz case. And if you then, you know, knowing that it's 10,000 Gs, you can estimate the maximum speed. The maximum speeds are coming out to around 250,000 miles an hour.
Insanity.
Which is insane. You know, it's so insane. The moon is slightly more than 250,000 miles away. You could, at those speeds, that object, size of an aircraft carrier, could get to the moon in less than an hour. And then people want to argue whether these are spaceships or not.
Right.
They could easily be spaceships. And they're not just, they couldn't just easily be spaceships. They are excellent spaceships. They're things that we would die to have. NASA would kill to have something like this. We're going to be going back to the moon in 2 years, and we're going to be launching a giant rocket, 300-foot-tall rocket with flames and fire and all this histrionics, and it's going to take them 3 days to get there. And we know, from evidence that you can get there in 50 minutes with an aircraft carrier. This is our situation.
It's mind-boggling to think about, because if you think about it, maybe that's only their minimum speed. Maybe that's just something that they can play with.
That might not be their best model.
That could be like that's their what do you call it? The Ford Fiesta of the fleet. You don't know. They could be, maybe they still got the Jag in the garage.
Right.
It is an insane.
What I find amazing at this point is we have enough evidence to know that it is possible that you could have a spacecraft the size of my Honda Accord that fits in your garage, and you could actually travel to other planets with that. We actually have
enough
data to know that that's possible. Somebody knows how to do that. I would like to. I would have loved to. I would love to have that capability.
I'm ready. Sign me up.
Sign me up.
I'm ready to go.
I'm ready to go.
Sign me up. So what I wanted to do, so we talked about that, but I wanted to, that was kind of the precursor to what you did. So you actually went with Kevin Day and your team and the team. I know that there are others on this team as well that you want to give credit to, but you put out a paper that was doing some work. Is around Catalina, was it not? It was in that basic general vicinity.
We went to Laguna Beach. Went to Laguna Beach, which looks out over Catalina Island, and we also had we split into two teams. We had the main team was on Laguna Beach. The second observation team was on Catalina Island, and we basically monitored the Catalina Channel for about 5 days.
Yes, and I'll let you tell the story. What did you, I know that there's a large paper out there, and I'm going to put a link to it as well. You work with UAPX, which you guys work on a lot of anomalous things, but you're more along the lines of doing data research and getting data and also figuring out what all that means. So are there ways that people, let's say, for example, they had another situation where we had radar hits or something like that. They could reach out to you guys, or do you not seek that out? What is the role of UAPX on that?
Oh, right. There are now several scientists, me, Professor Matthew Shadagas and Professor Cecilia Levy, who are professors of physics at the University in Albany. And we are collaborating with, and we have been collaborating with UAPX, which is a nonprofit organization. You can donate money if you like on their website.
I'll put that link too.
And we're in need of that because you can't apply for federal funds to study these things yet.
Right.
And so we physics professors are collaborating with UAPX to collect data on UAPs, to collect hard scientific data on UAPs. And that's really what our mission is. our first data collection mission was to observe the Catalina Channel in Southern California. And we got funded by Omnium Media, who and Caroline Corey, who made a documentary of our first efforts. So they were they basically funded the mission so that they had the rights to basically film us while we were working. And that was released in the movie A Tear in the Sky, which you can see on, I know you can get it on Amazon Prime. And
what were the results now of the paper? So you had this.
Right. So we have recently recently finished our summary paper, which basically describes the research that we did on this data collection mission. And in that paper, we talk about what we observed, and we also talk about what equipment we use, what methods we used, and lessons learned. And your first data collection mission, you don't really expect to make a huge discovery. You expect to what you can really hope for is hope to figure out how to do things better next time. And that's really what we did find. We found out we learned what we did wrong the first time around, what equipment worked. We learned what worked well. We learned what didn't work well. We learned, well, we really need this equipment. We didn't have this set up. We should have had that set up. And that's basically what happened. So the paper focuses mainly on that. We had 8 FLIR cameras, forward-looking infrared cameras, similar to what the military uses.
Right.
They were the PM695 FLIR cameras. And we basically monitored the sky continuously with them for 5 days. Now, that's a lot of data. Because somebody has to go back and rewatch all of those videos to look for things, right? And identify everything right in the picture. And that really was a lot of effort. So with 8 cameras, it came to something like 650 hours, if I'm remembering right. Nobody has, you got 650 hours to spare? You can sit and watch this video. It's basically a colored screen of infrared image of the sky.
And anything that goes by, you got to figure
anything
it out.
Anything that goes by, you have to note it, and we have to look at that closely. That's a lot of work. So Professor Matthew Shadagas did us a great service by writing a software package, which he calls CTAP, the Custom Target Analysis Protocol, which is a program that basically would watch the video for you and identify things that were moving around anomalously. And we tested that with observers watching the videos for, many hours. So we tested the software with that. The software was able to identify everything the people were able to identify, in addition to finding things that the people didn't notice, which was interesting. So there were, some other interesting things too that we could perhaps follow up on. Although I think that one of the problems was we don't have much data with many different modalities. We just, sometimes you get one thing happening on one camera and you say, well, what was that? Well, if you can't identify it from that camera, then you're out of luck. So you're going to need to. So that's one place where we had some lessons learned. Now, if you watch the movie, there are several, the movie of course is very exciting. We're very excited. There's a lot of excitement. We're excited because we're out there and very, very often sitting around for hours watching seagulls fly around. And then something happens and that there's a lot of excitement there. But very often the things that we saw initially and were excited about turned out to be normal things, And so, So one of those examples is the, I think the first thing that gets observed in the movie, and that was one of the first things we observed, was a bright light that was spotted by the guys on Catalina. Mm-hmm. So you had Dave Altman and Michael Hall observing on Catalina, and they observed this very bright continuous light moving slowly across the sky. They called us up and alerted us to this light, and we start looking for it from Laguna Beach. And while they're observing and filming it for a couple minutes or so, it then just disappears. And so this was a mystery object for us. We then sent out Jeremy McGowan was there with his OSIRIS, which was his mobile unit with equipment on it. And Jeremy McGowan went out with Jason Turner, and they went out, drove up closer to LA, toward Long Beach to see if they could see it along the coast there. And they made some observations of an object as well, which they weren't sure it was the same one. And then there were some strange things about that object because it showed up in one camera, but not the other. And
yes, I did. I watched that in the same
place. So it was a little strange. It turned out that one camera has, sees further into the infrared than the other does. And so we figure probably that thing was emitting in the infrared light, but wasn't able to be picked up by the visible light camera. So it was later discovered that that the objects that the guys saw on Catalina was the International Space Station. Now your first thought is, oh, how do you get tricked by that? yes, you can get an app for your phone to look that up. And it turned out that the app we were using had they had an error in the time due to daylight savings time. And so so we weren't aware that initially that was the International Space Station. And it was later figured out by, again, Matthew Shadagas figured this out, which was a really great move. He proposed that it was a space station. And the reason it disappeared is because it basically was moving into orbiting the Earth and moving into the shadow of the Earth. And so at first it's reflecting sunlight, so it's quite bright. You've got the large solar panels, which reflect the sunlight, so it's very bright. And then once you get into the shadow of the Earth, it just disappears. And that's typical for the space station. He was able to do a really nice calculation showing that if you measure the pixel size of the object in the images and you take into account the distance that the space station orbits at, you can estimate the size of the object. And he was able to estimate the size of the object as being about 110 feet across, which is about the size of the space station. So,
about the size of the space station.
So we're pretty confident that the first object we saw was the space station. There's a lot of spoilers in this. So if you haven't seen the movie yet, there's a lot of spoilers here. You might pause the podcast and go watch the movie and then come back.
oh no, I've seen it, but you know what? It's always fun to hear it. It's an enjoyable thing to listen and talk to the people that firsthand did this type of stuff, no matter what it is. It's just, it's always an exciting moment.
It was exciting. I remember the first thing I did when they saw the object is I grabbed a pair of night vision goggles and I went away from the rest of the group and just sat down on the roof and watched the channel. I had a pair of binoculars with me too, which you can't use with the night vision goggles, of course, but and I was watching the channel and I was seeing, and I think they did a recreation of this in the film, but the recreation wasn't exactly what it actually looked like. I saw several flashes of light on the surface of the water, which was a little surprising. They were rather bright, actually. And we never did figure out what that was. I don't think we got images of that on the infrared cameras either. So I'm not sure what I was seeing, but I saw three flashes of light on the surface.
Yeah, it seems like that would be an awfully long distance to have flashes of lights coinciding with what, you know, I don't know what the distance of the space station is, but that doesn't seem.
Yeah, on the surface of the water, so it was between. I was looking out over Catalina, so that those lights didn't have anything to do with the space station, and we never did figure out what those were. Which is unfortunate. So later at one point we had there was an event where we did see on one of the FLIR cameras, you could see streaks coming down, which looked like they were things falling into the water. And our And our first thought was, well, if that's real, then maybe that's what the flashes of light were. Maybe you've got things dropping into the water and you're getting a flash of light, infrared light, when with heated up water as it goes in. That correct. Was one yep. of my hypotheses there. But it then looking at that data, we became aware of the fact that that was just happening on one camera where you had eight of them. So it was probably a camera artifact. And indeed, we later were able to verify that that was a camera artifact. The camera was malfunctioning. And we got a hold of two engineers, one that worked at Teledyne and another one who also worked with that equipment, who verified that that's a known misbehavior of that kind of camera.
Okay. So, yeah, so that's, you know, at the end of the day, I think that what we need more of is these type of, I don't want to call them adventures. How about these type of events where we have teams going out there and looking at these areas? Because, you know, there seems to be hotbed activity in certain parts of the world. And what we need to do is we need to get more dollars and cents into this. And that's just the reality of it, is that we need to find more dollars that can go out there and that can support these, because it's obvious that our own, and we're speaking from the United States here, it's obvious that the United States knows a lot more than they're giving on. And in order for, I believe, disclosure to continue and move forward, it's going to take citizens, it's going to take academia, it's going to take private industry. You know, whether it's shooting a documentary style like that, or if we're doing something else, it's going to take that to help humanity figure out the question of what's going on in our skies, because we have a fundamental right as human beings to know where we are, no matter what. That's just my opinion. And I also believe it's not all right for anyone. Now, obviously, when you get into the woo of things, there are some aspects of this that could be benevolent, could be malevolent. We don't know exactly. But no matter what it is, I think that we all have a right to know. And I do believe, you know, with what UAPX is doing, and if we can get more teams even that are moving forward and getting this information, and everybody can put their information together, because it's really for the benefit of human beings in general, to get the answers that we deserve. You know, there are other cases. There are so many other cases out there where credible people have come forward and said, I've seen this. I know there's data for it because somebody took it away. And I do a lot of Freedom of Information Act requests. And if you can believe this, what I received back, probably a month or so ago, and I received it by mail instead of email. I received a hard copy of this letter, and the FOIA request was sent to the United States Air Force. And I asked, over the course of time between 2020 and 2023, up until I think it was September or October, all I wanted to know was how many anomalous contacts had occurred with aircraft with the United States Air Force. That's all I wanted. I didn't want to know any. They said they had none. If you believe that there were no anomalous contacts between
which we know is false, talking to the pilots.
I mean, we right. know yeah. right away is wrong. Yeah. And then false. They came forward and they said, we have no reporting mechanism for such. Well, what's Arrow supposed to be? So it's all a smoke and mirrors. It's an all, hey, we don't know anything. We know nothing. We're not going to tell you. And it's an over and over and over. And it's a cycle. Yeah,
the problem is that the government isn't one thing, right? The government is right. multiple agencies that are
correct.
You would hope would collaborate with each other, but they don't.
They do not.
And like any organization, that never works well. So it's difficult. And I think there are, you know, when we say that the government knows, you know, that's poorly phrased, because
it is.
What it means is there is an agency with certain people who know something, right? And other people don't, even in the same agency or different agencies. And so it's very difficult. And that makes the FOIA request difficult, because there's no way for the person trying to fulfill the FOIA request to know where to look for the information. And that's very difficult. Yeah.
I have a friend that's in Arrow, and I actually I'm not going to mention names of people, but I have, we have a lot of mutual friends. And I verified this person's bona fides with another person. So I know that the person that I'm talking to is the right person. But even they stated to me, even though Arrow is set up as an office to receive these reports, to figure out the information, some of this goes not above that, but above that. Like there are steps to this that go to a certain, I don't know if it's an individual, an office or what, I have no idea. But they go to people that are not even on the radar. Like you wouldn't even know their names. They're in positions of authority. And the reason why they're there and why you don't know their names is because they're completely compartmentalized. There's no way you're going to learn that information. Like you're not going to know. And I was told Arrow is just the front face of this. That's it. Like you're never going to get real information from a front facing organization like that. I mean, just listen to I don't care what political spectrum you are. You listen to any political discussion 50 years and forward, they tell you what they want you to hear. And that's the same thing with Arrow. And that's why I say we've got to put a lot more onus on individuals, on
I say the same thing. I say that, you know, we need to have the scientific community involved. Scientists need to study this like they study every other phenomenon. And the
stigma has to go. It has to go.
Yeah, and the fact is, whether you like it or not, people do see strange things that can't be identified. That happens.
Right.
It does happen, and they can't be identified. And, you know, contrary to popular belief, what keeps being said, scientists have seen them. Astronomers have seen them. This is not rare.
Our own space, astronauts
have seen them. Cosmonauts have come forward seeing these things. Yeah, exactly. In fact, there's a lot known about this. And in fact, during the Manhattan Project and afterwards, there were a lot of UFOs seen in the area of Los Alamos and White Sands, missile base. And in fact, there was So Clyde Tombaugh, who discovered Pluto, the astronomer who discovered Pluto, had seen one of these objects. There was a rash of sightings, which they called green fireballs, which green balls of light that would race across the sky. And Clyde Tombaugh had seen at least one. He might have seen three, if I remember right. And they actually would show up around nuclear testing sites, which worried the people in the Manhattan Project. So they actually had meetings at Los Alamos to discuss these objects. And in fact, these meetings were interesting because when they would have these meetings, they didn't have a discussion as to whether they were real or not, if they were really seeing these things. And the reason was because almost every scientist who worked at Los Alamos at the time had actually seen them themselves. So this wasn't, these things weren't, you know, and I'm talking about famous scientists, you know, who worked on the Manhattan Project. So.
Yeah, there wasn't a debate.
Edward Teller. Teller saw them. Right. Teller saw them. He invented the hydrogen bomb. He was at the meeting and he had seen them himself as well. So they actually had, I've got to remember names now, which is getting harder and harder.
Welcome to the club.
Yeah, I'm forgetting the guy's name. There was a meteor expert who was put in charge of that program to identify these green fireballs. And he was an expert at taking sightings of a meteor. He did this regularly because this was his job. He would take sightings of a meteor and then plot out its trajectory and then go look for it. And he would recover the meteor. And that's what he did as a meteorite specialist. So he was put in charge of this problem. And his conclusion was at this, you know, they had several meetings of this. His conclusion was these aren't meteors. They're the wrong color. They don't have, they're green, but they're not the right color of green. They, the, he plotted trajectories of several of these. They weren't always going down. They were sometimes going up, which meteorites don't do. And he was never able to recover a meteor from any of the trajectories that went down, which he said that he's never had that problem with real meteorites. And he said the speeds were different. The behaviors were different.
If I remember it, there was, I do remember some of this. There were no contrails in some of these. It was,
no,
if
there's
you see
no
a meteor coming in,
there's
it's
no
got
contrails.
A, it's got
and,
a contrail.
The, and the idea that this is a meteor shower or something, well, if it's a meteor shower, why is it just happening within three counties of New Mexico?
Right.
They should be being seen all
Something's
over the place,
wrong.
And they weren't. And that's another problem. And then you've got the problem of a meteor shower shouldn't just last for 9 months. A meteor shower happens when the Earth moves through a cloud of debris that's orbiting the sun and gets showered by that debris. And then the next year goes through it again. That's what happens with a meteor shower. But the scientists there wanted to say, well, it's just a meteor shower. Well, no, it lasted for 9 months and then didn't repeat. This is
these not only that. And yeah, and you can just like you said, you can predict a meteor shower. That's why we have the Leonids. It's why we have all these meteors. You can predict them. They're there.
Right. Exactly.
You know,
and
yeah, it's a very odd thing, but then, you know, and you're talking about, so let's go back to the technology of the '40s, right?
Right.
I don't really have an answer for that other than to say there was nothing. I mean, there's nothing.
Yeah, no, these aren't human grade craft. That's not even reasonable to begin worrying about that. And Dr. LaPaz is his name. I just looked it up on the paper. I actually have a paper that I've written where I talk about this that's not published yet. It was meant to be a research paper that I was going to present, publish in the new journal Limina, which is a new UFO journal, but I started writing this paper and it's now 70 pages long. So it's too big for a research paper. So on one hand, I'm embarrassed because it's 70 pages long, but on the other hand, it's like, there's so much information here that I was.
Well, now you got a book.
Well, it has to go into a book. And so someday it'll be a book, but yeah, it'll have to be that because I can't just not publish it and just sit on it. I have to put it out there at some point. Yeah, but it was Dr. LaPaz was the person who was in charge of this.
I'm curious, of all the cases that you know and or have looked into and looked at, is there one that keeps you up at night over others? Is there one that just bugs you that says, I want to know what this was? It's just, you know, Jacques Vallée is a gentleman that has been doing this for his entire life. And, you know, he stated in several interviews that he's had cases that just bug him, that just it's one of those things that he can't figure it out one way or another. And even he says he doesn't know what these are completely. There's a lot of, are they a conscious thing? Are they a technological thing? Are they combined? Are they, what are they? You know,
well,
what's
gets,
going
that
on?
That gets again into a messy area, which makes this really difficult because the patterns of activity that you see when you start looking at many of these cases, you start to realize that the sightings are strange. They're not always they're not always simple. And the people's descriptions of them are strange. There's other things going on and it's complicated. And I think that in Jacques Vallée has, you know, stated that he has a hard time believing that these are just alien spacecraft. And he's probably right. And I don't think for me, there isn't a single case that just stands out. I probably haven't dove into a lot of those cases. As a physicist, I've tried to stay with cases where I can perhaps glean some insight into the physics or engineering behind these objects. And so I've kind of limited my perspective to only looking at certain types of cases. And if I were to do that, I would have to say that the Japanese airline case, the JAL 1628 case, is probably one of the most interesting. I mean, you've got a craft that's shaped like a walnut that's the size of an aircraft carrier, moving at speeds that can get you to the moon in an hour. What is going on with that? What is that real? It has to be real. I mean, that's what the data tells us. That's what all, and a traditional scientist might object to the use of the word data. Well, it's not scientific data. It wasn't taken with calibrated instruments, but now it's still information. I can learn from information. And
there were three sources, were there not? There was plane data. There was data from ground-based radar.
Yep. And then military radar.
Yes, there were three sources of data there. Yeah, that's right. It's not just one.
In that case, you actually do have data.
Right.
You do have data. So that's so it's a different type of case. But,
you know, if one goes wrong, you could make the case that one was wrong. But all three, in this instance, are correlating the data. They're all saying the same thing. So it's not like you have one thing that could have malfunctioned. I can agree with one piece of equipment malfunctioning, right? Oh, yeah, that happens.
All three, it just happened with the camera the same way at the same time. That's exactly right.
I just don't know why this case isn't a bigger case, because when you learn about all of that information that's out there, I mean, that's a smoking gun to me. I mean, as close to a smoking gun as you can get, right?
I remember because that case stands out to me because I remember it on the nightly news. I remember seeing it on NBC Nightly News in 1986. It was Connie Chung and Tom Brokaw, and they were all worked up about this UFO that followed this Japanese airplane for 45 minutes. And I remember watching that thinking, my God, this is amazing. And the next day I went and I clipped a newspaper article out about it. And I kept that. And this was 1986. I was in college at the time. Yeah, that's a long time ago. But I remember it being on TV. It was a big deal.
Rightly so.
I mean, if these things are...
Not only rightly so. I'm wondering... It didn't get much more traction in the mainstream media. Is that because, do you believe, it was clamped down in such a way that there was going to be no more discussion about it? Or do you think it just...
No, you don't have to... It doesn't take... You know, we know that the government's been... I don't like using the word conspiracy because everybody jumps on conspiracy theory, right?
Agreed.
All they have to do is be quiet about it. There's a lot of things that aren't secret that are kept quiet, right? And that's all that needed to happen. And this isn't the UFO phenomenon isn't anything that has to be covered up. All you have to do is make a joke and everybody giggles and walks away. That's all you need to do. And so, you know, the media isn't going to want to touch it. And that's continues to be a problem. I mean, you can't have discussions without there being some kind of joke coming up. And why? Perhaps because the topic makes people nervous, right? And rightfully so. You know, you should be a little nervous. This is a big unknown. I did an interview for Russia Channel 1 2 years ago. And this was they had a whole piece, what, 12-minute piece or something on the Pentagon Task Force to look at UFOs, right? This is what led to Arrow happening. So this is Russia Channel 1, and I did an interview. And in the middle of this piece, before I come on the screen, they have some cute graphic of showing Moscow, and they have some cartoony alien craft comes in with a little green man inside the craft. Right. And he hovers and then takes off. And so they go from being serious, talking about the Pentagon, to that. And then they have me in the interview, and it's just like, it's just this huge disconnect. They're like,
what just happened?
You know, what just happened?
Right.
You know, and I think a lot of it is, humans trying to deal with something that's uncomfortable. And yeah, it's uncomfortable.
And you're dead on, because I've noticed that it's almost this juxtaposition of, we're going to talk about this, but we're going to kind of make fun of it at the same time, because
but we're going to have to make a joke just because, it's that's exactly it. And I deal with stressful situations the same way. I remember remember a family member was in the hospital once when I was in high school, and we were in the emergency room just making fun of things. Just laughing like crazy, making jokes, because what else are you going to do at that point?
You can't.
But I think that's the same situation here. This is a,
I know, I don't know if you saw it, but Jeremy Corbell did Jeremy Corbell did an interview, and they had made, like, when they came on, when Jeremy came on the screen, or just before, the young lady that was doing the interview was cracking jokes about tinfoil hats or something. I don't remember exactly what it was, but he came on and he was angry. You know, he was like a little offended, because and some of the other things is, I've been shown things just like Jeremy has that I probably shouldn't have been shown. And I've had people that have talked to me that probably shouldn't have said the things that they said to me, but through my keeping my mouth shut for certain things, I've had a little bit of trust thrown my way, which is great. Certainly not at the level that he has, but at the same time, I kind of understand what he's talking about, because I'm certain that he's seen some of the other things that I may or may not have seen. And it's not funny, but it's at the same time, you're right. It's human nature to joke about things. I do the same thing. I'm terrible with going to funerals, right? I hate it. I'm just terrible. Like, I'll laugh at something.
I went to a friend's father died, and
it's not intentional,
which shouldn't be happening. But
it's not intentional. It's just how it's a heady subject, and the fact that we're not alone. I mean, I am 100% between the things that I've seen, between the evidence that's been shown to me, there's no doubt in my mind.
The Schumer proposal for disclosure that just got shut down, that mentioned non-human intelligence something like 20 times in it.
Right.
Non-human intelligence. We know at this point that this is the most probable situation that we're dealing with. And that's nerve-wracking. That's worrisome. I talked to somebody knowledgeable about the topic who can't share everything, from the Pentagon. And we had a conversation, and I asked point blank, I said, how many craft like this are operating in the Earth environment at any given time? I said, can you just give me a rough estimate? Are we dealing with 10 craft, 100 craft, 1,000 craft, 10,000? And his response was, we don't know.
We don't know.
And I said, wait, but just ballpark. You don't even know ballpark. He goes, no, we don't even know. 100, 10,000, 100,000, we don't know. And I was astounded. And that should make you concerned, because we are now aware of the fact that some of these things might be non-human craft, but our government doesn't even know about how many there are. If this is really our situation, this is a horrible state of ignorance to be in. And shame on the people in the government who have kept this quiet for 80 years, because they've kept people like me who would study this from doing so and perhaps answering these questions. I mean, we need to know these things. They need to know these things. What are they doing to find out the answer? What are they doing? And the United States is just one country on the planet. I mean, you know, we always focus, you know, I'm American, so I focus on the United States, but what about the other countries? What are they doing? What do they know? What are they, you know, where are they in this conversation? It's frustrating.
That was part of my conversation with my gentleman with Arrow. And I have to preface this by saying he's not necessarily in Arrow. He is adjacent to and or in and or around, because I want to protect his identity. But one of the things that we talked about quite a bit was they don't know as much as we think we think as in we community.
Yeah. I don't think they know much at all, actually.
Right.
Between you and me, so I have like they don't
they really have these bits and pieces. They have the bits and pieces. But whether it has been through keeping this information compartmentalized, or just through secrecy in general, it seems that they, and if this was confirmed to me, we know quite a bit, but we don't know anywhere near what the public, quote unquote, thinks that the government knows. And
we don't know what we need to know, I think, is the other problem.
Exactly.
And this is where disclosure goes awry. And I think this is one of the disclosure problems, is that once somebody comes out and actually says, I mean, we've had enough disclosure already to have a pretty good idea of what's going on. If you're paying any kind of attention, you should be pretty confident that this is the situation. But we haven't had an announcement, right? And you can't have that, because there are going to be questions. There's going to be lots of questions to which there's no answers. You don't want to be a public servant who comes out and makes an announcement and can't answer any questions. You're going to look horrible. And this is, so Biden's not going to make any kind of announcement anytime soon. You know, this is why the Schumer proposal was 2030. You know, that's what, 6 years from now. You know, maybe somebody will have some answers, maybe somebody would have some answers in 6 years. Maybe that's the hope.
Right.
But you're not going to get answers by being compartmentalized and having agencies not talk to each other. And my solution to this is get scientists involved. Once, you know, and getting us involved isn't easy, because you're going to have to convince the majority of scientists to understand that this is real and it's a real problem, which they don't yet. I've been fortunate that my colleagues are like, yeah, well, this is interesting. And, you know, you're a scientist, so you should study it, of course. But I'm not going to do it. And they run off the stage.
Right.
Right. So, but I'm not going
to
do this.
But you're in this community. What do we need to do to destigmatize it? Do we need to do to destigmatize? You're in this community. You talk to these people every day. What do we need to do to destigmatize?
We need to present some kind of evidence that it's real. Something. The paper that I wrote on speeds and accelerations did a lot of good, but it wasn't. It's not quite enough, right? It did a lot of good. It got, in fact, Daniel Kouambe, who had done the analysis of the JAL Airlines and estimated the 10,000 G accelerations, you know, he had contacted me because he was inspired by my paper to do this. So yeah, it did good. Transparent about this type of research and what I've learned, it has done some help, and it's made some people aware of the fact that, yeah, this is actually interesting and there could be something to this. I think once people realize that this is real and a real problem, it doesn't take long to realize that this is probably one of the biggest scientific discoveries in human history.
The biggest.
And in fact, that was the question that I had gotten when I first presented my work on speeds and accelerations. I was at a scientific conference at the Max Planck Institute for Plasma Physics in Germany, where I presented that. And one of my colleagues asked me point blank, he said, why would you do this to yourself? Why are you talking about this topic? And I said, because if this is real, then this is the biggest discovery in human history. I'm not going to walk away from that. I'm not going to be 20 years from now looking back at my career and kicking myself for, well, I wish I'd have actually studied that when I had the chance. I don't want to be in that situation. And that's why I'm here. My advisor in graduate school discovered that the surface of the sun was oscillating. They were actually trying to study neutrinos, and they were doing something. I don't remember what the details were, but they were doing something. And with their equipment, they couldn't do what they wanted because they realized that the sun was vibrating. And they gave up on the experiment. They just said, well, we can't do this because the sun's vibrating. And they walked away. And then years later, somebody discovers that the sun and surface is vibrating, and they start the whole field of solar seismology, and they get a Nobel Prize for it, right? My advisor knew that. My advisor knew that was happening 10 years before. But
you never know.
He didn't
bother. You never know.
He didn't bother to look at it, right? And he kicked himself for that. So that's where I sit with the UFO topic. I'm like, I'm not walking away from this. There's no way. It's a big deal.
Is there something that you would see? So you talked a little bit about disclosure, and I maintain that, and Steve Bassett talks about this, disclosure with the big D, little d. And I maintain, if I have any type of influence at all, that disclosure with a small d has occurred. We have our own lawmakers right now. And again, this is both sides of the aisle. When you talk about politics, I try to be as agnostic with politics as I can. Just because I don't want it involved in what I'm doing and what I'm trying to achieve. But you've got AOC, and then you've got Tim Burchett. Two people that could not be more opposite.
More different.
Political. Yeah. I mean, yeah, could no, not be.
They're on the same committee, and they're of like mind on this topic. And you know, bravo to both of them. I'm proud of both of them for doing what they did.
I mean,
and there's going to be a meeting this week with the Inspector
General.
When
do they ever not agree with each other? Ever?
Yeah,
they don't. I mean, they agree on alone.
But the fact that they agree on this topic says something powerful, right? It says something. It highlights the fact that we actually have a real problem on our hands, where politics gets pushed aside. We don't need to. We can't bother to worry about politics right now because this is an actual problem. And that's what they're basically telling you. They're basically shouting that from
they're screaming from that out. Look, you've got Rounds on one side, Schumer on the other. Two people in the Senate, again, that could not be more different from their political beliefs.
That's right.
And then you had, and you look at Harry Reid. Now, I don't know this for sure, but I think Harry Reid and Schumer were obviously very close friends. And Schumer has said that. And I think that Chuck Schumer knows a heck of a lot more about this than he's leading on. Like you said, it was like 24 or 27 mentions.
Something like that. To put that proposal
that language
forward, and that language forward, you know, shows that he really knows what's going on. Yeah.
Yeah. There was no accident with that amendment in any way, shape, or form. That was not accidental in any way. And I'll tell you that.
So they're doing both, everybody, you know, both, you know, Burchett, Rounds, Schumer, Gillibrand, AOC, all of those people are doing not only our country, but humanity a service by pushing on this. And
now you've got Burleson.
I'm grateful for them. And Rubio, I mean, let's keep them all together.
If you listen to the when David Grush had, and it was Grush, Fravor, and Graves were doing that, that I guess it was a sworn testimony.
Right.
Eric Burleson was a huge skeptic. If you listen to anything that Burleson is saying now, somebody must have got to him and either shown him something or given him different
information.
Well,
they had behind the door meetings, and they got to see classified info.
Yep, because he is 180
degrees. Every time any one of those people comes out of one of those sessions, their attitude is different. And
it is.
And we know, I mean, yeah.
Yeah.
This is of huge importance, and it's getting missed by the media. It's getting missed by everybody. It's surprising.
It needs to be on every channel 24/7, as far as I'm concerned, because it's a real thing. And like I said, I believe small d disclosure has occurred, because even with Burchett, he's come out and he said, we're not alone. I mean, when a sitting congressman comes out and says those words to you,
right?
Number one, that's political suicide, right? Because if it's fake,
it's
political. These guys are not doing this because they want.
No.
You know, it's nonsensical when I hear people
this
say
is,
it's not
this
real.
This is
it's
a problem fake. That we need to address. And that's really, that's what's clear about it at this point.
Yeah, it is.
I just wish their fellow scientists could get on board. They can't get past the whole. They're stuck in scientism, where it's almost a religion. We know what we know, and I don't believe any of that stuff. I mean, that's really what that's where science becomes religion. You have to entertain other hypotheses. Look at the data. Look at the information. And the information all says this is really interesting and really weird. And
I'll tell you, it's
there's nothing more exciting than that as a scientist. So I don't understand where my colleagues are. You know, why aren't they jumping on board? Well, they have. I mean, Professor Shadagas and Professor Levy both jumped on board. Yeah, they were both like, yeah, I would like to study this with you. So
what do you think of Avi Loeb's work?
I'm sorry,
what do you think of Avi Loeb's work?
I mean, every one of these groups is helping in some way, right? I'm very good friends with Wes Waters, who is the lead scientist on the Avi Loeb's Galileo project, and Wes is fantastic. And we're all working for the same goal, and we're trying to help each other, you know, where we can. So scientists do collaborate. We're not all competitive all the time, and there are several other scientific groups. You've got the VASCO project in Sweden, run by Beatrix Villarreal, who she's looking at old photographic plates to identify objects in orbit. And she's had some success. And then you've got Hakan Kayal with IFEX in Germany. They actually now have a program at the University of Würzburg in Germany to, you know, offer degrees to people studying UFOs. So, I mean, things are changing. They are changing, and you can see that happening with the scientists who are getting involved. It's still very few people, but it's making a difference.
So before we wrap up, I want to ask your opinion on one thing. So let's go back 80 years, 80 plus years, to Roswell, New Mexico. So we know that something occurred, right? It was told that it was a weather balloon. Then we were told that it was a project that was being used for the Russians to check this, or I don't know. I
think it was to check nuclear weapon signatures.
Yeah, something like that. What do you think happened? Because I've had people that are supposedly in the know say that in the 30s, now this was something that was told to me, that in the 30s we recovered a craft, whether this was the Italian craft or whatever it was, and that we were trying to do a recreation. We tried to make that. And when we tried to make it, we obviously made some mistakes, and somehow we crashed this thing in the Nevada desert. I was told by someone else, a friend of mine that is in the, I was told by Ross Coulthard, let's just say that in fact, I just, you know, Ross, if you're mad at me for saying your name, I'm sorry. I'm going to put it out there. That in fact, it was a real UFO that crashed, and that was where the cover up came from. You know, part of that came from, the experiments that were taken out with Oppenheimer. So, and that's why it was compartmentalized the way it was. What are your thoughts on Roswell? Do you think that really happened? What do you, you know, just from a you point of view, it doesn't have to be even scientific.
No, that's a great question. There's a few things. The one is if you look at the number of UFO sightings from in 1947, Ted Bletcher published these early on. He scoured newspapers to get these. And you basically go from the number of sightings being about 7 sightings per day in June to jumping up to about 250 sightings in early July of 1947. Mm-hmm. It jumps up in a matter of 3 days. Right around the time when you have Kenneth Arnold's sightings in near Mount Rainier in Washington, you have Roswell, which happens just before the 4th of July. You've got so you jump up from about 7 sightings a day to something like 250 sightings a day across the country. And these weren't all trivial sightings. Some of these were from airplanes, from jet airplanes with UFOs following jet airplanes, There were landings witnessed by 60 people in some cases in Idaho. That all happened within about a week. And then it drops back down to about 7 sightings per day. Something weird happened around that time. Now, is that sociological? I can't say. I'm not a sociologist, and you'd have to study this carefully, and you'd have to look at the newspaper reports and see how fast the newspaper reports propagated and whether you can explain a spike like this. But it's a spike. It's a spike with, I forget how many sigma of significance it had. I actually have my paper here. That's also in my 70-page paper. Which,
see, I led you right into that.
Someday will become a book. Yeah, no, it wasn't 250 sites. Sightings. It goes up to 100, about 160 sightings. It's about that increase of the number of sightings is about what we would in science would call 22 standard deviations above the background. Something like 6 standard deviations are what particle physicists need to announce the Higgs boson, right?
This is 22 significant.
This is 22 significant is standard deviations. It's a huge difference. Something really weird happened that week. Now, and Roswell was just one of the things. Now, whatever happened at Roswell caused panic. I mean, the government was panicked. The military was panicked. The sheriff went out there to investigate by himself, actually took a neighbor, like an 8-year-old neighbor with him, went out and investigated himself. And then when that was found out, the sheriff was detained for 5 days and questioned. When does the military come in and detain a sheriff for 5 days? Do you do that for a weather balloon? No. You do that for a device that detects nuclear weapons that's made of aluminum foil and balsa wood, as they would, you know, as the pictures showed? No, you don't do that. You do that for something really crazy important. I don't know what that was. Whatever it was significant. It was really significant. And yeah, it's easy to blow it off and laugh, ha, 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 Roswell. But no, something crazy significant happened there. That was a big deal because our military overreacted, like really overreacted. And we've heard multiple excuses. You know, what was the first excuse? Well, within 2 days, you had a newspaper report that came from the Air Force itself that said that they recovered a disc. That was the first explanation. The second explanation is a weather balloon. The next explanation is Project Mogul, or they're dropping dummies from a... Why are they dropping dummies? Why would they even say they're dropping dummies unless there were people found, right? That's weird. But these were all the excuses that were given. I'm sorry, when an agency just starts making up and throwing excuses at you, which one do you believe? You believe the first one. You believe the first one that they quashed, right? And what was that first one? They recovered a disc.
Yeah.
And they quashed that really quickly.
Like that. It was
with panic. Yeah. Yeah. With panic. They didn't. That's the true story. That's my belief. They found a disc. Yeah.
And
it's to me, it's obvious. That's what happened. It's their reaction that makes it obvious. It's their
right.
It's their horribly vigorous denial that makes it obvious.
You think it really was brought to Wright-Patterson? We have it, and bodies
that probably, that probably is all true. Yeah,
yeah.
I mean, and there were plenty of witnesses. This goes along with what the witnesses say, and it's all pretty consistent. I think that's what happened. And now that we know more about these objects, and we know how they behave, and we know what they look like, what there's a shapes report that was, you know, the shapes table was originally redacted, right? Which they now have released. We know how they're shaped. This is what they recovered.
Here's an interesting question and I've never asked this before. From a physics point of view, is there a benefit to having a craft that is disc shaped, bell shaped, versus having rocket shape slash plane shape? I mean, what is I guess you'd have to assume that there are other technologies at play if you have something shaped like a saucer, because to me, it doesn't seem like the most apropos way to make a craft. To me, right. The most apropos way to make a craft would almost be like a Sea Ray kind of. It seems like.
Well, I mean, a saucer in your first pass at this as a scientist would be, a saucer is great for a great airfoil, right? It's a great airfoil. It will move nicely through the air, right? That's probably the first pass. But the problem is that we know that they don't interact with the air somehow, because there are no fireballs and there's no sonic boom. So they're not interacting with the air, and the saucer shape wouldn't have anything to do with that. Right. So that's weird. Second, the craft aren't always observed to move that way. They hover like this. They actually, when they move, they actually tip up on end and they fly bottom forward. Hermann Oberth even mentions this in his 1950s talk. So this has been known again for 80 years, and that's been observed. So they fly bottom forward, which is totally against any aerodynamics, you know. So they're not using aerodynamics. Aerodynamics is off the table. It's not an issue with their technology. I have no idea what their technology is at this point. And there are, you know, some physicists who claim to know, but they don't have any data, so they don't actually know. You've got to compare your theories to data. So we don't have enough data at this point.
And do you think that there is a technological change? Because if you look at what is, and I promise I won't keep you much longer, but I wanted to get these questions in. So if you go back 80 years, a lot of the sightings were disc-like objects, bell-shaped objects. If you go to, you know, the Das Bell with Germany, there's speculation that there was the bell that Hitler had hold of, and they even have the same. They have this four-pillared cement thing that in the middle of the woods where they thought that the bell was, and there's like some stuff there. But is there a change maybe in technology that has occurred with possibly an NHI that they went away from the shape of a saucer and now are more towards an orb shape? Because if you look at today's sightings, many, not all, but many of today's sightings are of a gray orb, luminous orbs, but a little bit away from
that. 80 years ago, you've got the Foo Fighters in the 1940s, correct, which were all orbs.
Right. True. And when my dad was...
I think the situation's complicated. I think that we don't know a lot. We don't know that they are all one thing. So I'm often asked, how do UFOs fly? Well, that's almost like asking, how does a car drive? How does a car engine work? Well, what are you talking about? An electric car engine and a gasoline powered car engine, a diesel car engine? They're different. They're all different. A hybrid car engine, you know, they're all different. And so saying how a UFO works isn't exactly a precise question. It's not a useful question. And we don't know how many different types of UFOs there are, you know, how many models there are. We also don't know how many, we don't know anything about the non-human intelligences that are behind these objects, and, or how many types of non-human intelligences there are, how many species or races are on Earth at any given time. They might not all be from the same place. I think it's a difficult thing to, it's difficult to address. And I think that is a confounding factor that's making studies of UFOs hard, right? Because we mm-hmm. don't know where they're all from or what they all are. We have problems classifying them. And then that's one of the first things you do when you study things. And we find that hard to do when we have this paucity of information.
I think that it's a question that I'm hoping is going to begin to be answered a little bit more in 2024. I'm hoping I don't, I get conflicting reports with people that I speak with behind the scenes. And some of them are saying that, and I had some confirmation of this through someone else, that basically that the president does want to be the disclosure president. And then I have other news that comes back to me and says he does not want to be the disclosure president. Then I have, you know, it's tough because you get all these confounding variables that come at you, and it's like, you know,
if he's got that decision to make, I wouldn't want to have to make that decision. That would be hard to do.
It is.
Yeah, I would want to disclose, but again, then you've got the questions to answer, which you can't answer. And that's tough. So it's not obvious what the best thing, for the president to do would be, from the president's perspective, right? I don't know what the best thing would be. I think that this is unfortunately, it's going to be, where I don't think so much of it is being little d disclosure. I think that this is disclosure. Disclosure is a process. It's going to have to be a long process. And we're in it. We're in the middle of it, and I think that's a good thing. And I think it would be better for scientists to get involved so that we can start getting some answers, get some actual data, some real answers, and where we can be confident in what those answers are. Because at this point, you've had a government that's kept this secret. Well, not just a government, hundreds of governments around the world that have kept the secret for 80 years at least. And it's going to be hard to trust what their answers are. It's going to be hard to trust what they tell you because they've been lying to you for 80 years. That makes it hard. And that's why I think it's really paramount to get scientists involved studying these things. Let's get some real answers. Let's actually study this. Let's start to learn what they are, where they're from, and how they work, and get to business.
Yep, I agree 100%. Well, Professor, I appreciate your time this evening. It's been a long time coming.
I'm glad we're finally together. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely, this was fun. I'd like to do it again sometime. It's great talking to you. I like talking to you in the background. So I wish you the very best new year, 2024.
You too.
Hoping for great, awesome things.
Well, we're going to learn. We're going to learn some things, and we're going to keep learning things. This is happening, and it's going to happen. It has to happen at this point. And they have to. This has to continue. I mean, eventually, you are going to have an encounter with one of these things that can't be ignored, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, what happens if you get a crash in New York City? What's the chance? I don't know what the chance of that is. That's a good question. And me and Professor Shadagos, Matthew Shadagos, talk about that a bit. If that happens, then it's a big problem. And what happens when the Chinese come out and disclose before everybody else does? And how is that going to make everybody else look? That's
not good.
A problem. Yeah, it's not going to look good for the rest of us. It's not going to look good for the West. If Russia or Chinese come out first. So that's some impetus for Biden to come out. But it's going to be difficult to come out. So it would be best to have a plan, which is what Schumer was trying to do. And it's too bad that got shot down. I mean, there was aerospace interests that basically got shot that down, which is, again, telling, right? Tells us what the situation is and tells us how important it is. The aerospace industry doesn't want people knowing that this technology can exist, and they want to fight over it themselves. I mean, but just like what would happen to the airline industry if it turns out that we can all have cars that can get from New York to London in 5 minutes? You can get from New York to London faster than you can take a taxi across Manhattan. How is that going to change things?
It's going to destroy industries is what it's going to do.
It's incredibly disruptive. It's going to destroy industries. It's going to cause lots of job loss. It's going to cause all sorts of disruption, but it's going to make things better in a lot of other ways. I mean, it's disruption. And that's really the problem with all of this. It's disruption. It's all disruptive.
Well, I think it's very interesting that when I query Lockheed Martin about UAPs, Their answer is the UAP question is best answered by the federal government. That's their answer. That's their answer. They will not do anything except say, if you say, do you have UAP crash retrieval? Do you have debris? Do you have this? Their answer always is, and I'm not the only one that gets this answer. Their answer always is, questions about UAPs and UFOs are best answered by our federal government. That's our only statement. That's
I can
it.
See that. I'd rather that scientists answer those questions. We ought to be on the ball here.
Yep. Agreed. Sounds great. Thank you, Professor. I appreciate your time very much.
Thank you so much.
It's been a blast. And you have a great evening.
Thank you. You as well. Bye.
Thank you, Professor. Bye-bye.